On this edition of the podcast exclusive feature of Extension 720, we welcome Isabel Wilkerson, who adds to our list of former Pulitzer Prize winners. But you were the winner in 1994 when you were the head of the Times Bureau, the New York Times Bureau, here in Chicago.
I was. I won in 1994 for coverage of the Midwest floods, 500-year floods, and also for a story about a 10-year-old boy who was leading a man's life. And those three stories won the feature writing prize for the Pulitzer Prize.
Very, very significant achievement for a very young woman at the time. And now you're a few years older, about 15 or 16 years older. And you've spent the last 15 years, I am told, and I can well believe it, doing the new book now in hand, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. That's the migration of American blacks from the South to the North.
Yes, it's the I view it as the biggest underreported story of the 20th century. It occurred from 1915 to 1970 and involved 6 million African Americans who left all parts of the South to all points north and west and changed the country. It was a total redistribution of an entire people. And it occurred in some ways as a defection from the caste system. That's how I view it, a defection from the caste system known as Jim Crow. And I like to say that they moved from the South to the North for the same reasons that anyone ever crossed the Atlantic in steerage or crossed the Pacific Ocean in hopes of a better life in the New World.
Well, I'm in the same category as you are, the child of migrants. My parents migrated from Eastern Europe in the 1920s, and I suppose they came because of very poor opportunity for advancement in life for East European Jews. My father came as a boy of 14, I think, and went back after World War I, long after, by the mid-20s, to find a wife in his old hometown. And he did, and brought her back. But your parents came from...
My mother came from Rome, Georgia, a small town in North Georgia, to Washington, D.C., the end of World War II. And my father came from a small town in Southern Virginia, Petersburg, Virginia, to Washington, D.C., where they met. And I think that's in some ways a classic American story, because how many of us, in your case, your father went back to get a wife, but many people just married whoever they met in the New World. And that means that for many Americans, they are descended from people who might never have met had there not been someone in their lineage who left the only place they ever knew for a place far away here.
You were raised in Washington.
I was raised in Washington.
Yeah. And you went to and were the editor of the newspaper at what I suppose would be called the leading American historically black, as they say.
Yes.
University, Howard University.
Howard University.
Yeah. I had the pleasure of lecturing there once many years ago. Knew some people there in the sociology department. And, of course, around Howard you would learn from the faculty and from some of the students that there is a black aristocracy in Washington which differentiated itself from the migrants.
Yes, in some ways that happened in all the cities where it occurred. I mean, it happened here in Chicago, it happened in Los Angeles, wherever they went. I mean, it's kind of a basic human instinct that once you arrive in a place, you want to get a foothold there and you get established. And then when there are new people coming, even if they're coming from the same background and culture and homeland that you were coming from, there's this feeling of insecurity and people act out on that. I mean, they were often very rejecting. Some of the most painful experiences that some people might have had when they migrated from the South to the North was the rejection that they experienced from the people who were here already. The elites did not want them here. They had barely had a foothold themselves, and they were feeling quite at risk for what little status they had. And so they had, actually the Urban League and the Chicago Defender had do's and don'ts for people when they arrived so that they were to make sure that their children had shoes on. They had to actually write these out and they passed them around to the migrants after they arrived to let them know how they were to behave in the North.
That totally parallels what happened to the American Jews. The first major wave of Jewish immigration was German in origin and way back from even before the middle of the 19th century, on through the 19th century. And they became the well-established shopkeepers and department store owners and professionals and so on.
The elites.
They became the elite. And the later migrants who came from Eastern Europe were definitely looked down upon by them, though they also took it upon themselves as an obligation to educate them and to shape them in Western ways.
One of the comments that one of the people who were the elites, you might say, in this very early wave of migration from the South, when the newcomers came, this woman was asked, what do you think about these people coming? Aren't you embarrassed or ashamed? You know, what are your thoughts? And she said, well, maybe they will not learn all of the ways of the North and maybe not be able to take advantage of it. But maybe their children will, and their children's children will. So she had an enlightened view of the potential of these people. So that in some ways, the people who were all coming to these big industrial cities, these forbidding, alienating places, in some ways, one of the greatest, to me, saddest tragedies of the 20th century is that they were all coming as the same people. The people coming in from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, from parts of rural Asia, and people coming from the South, they were the same people. They were the people of the land. They were people who may not have had the best education because they had not been permitted to have so much education where they were coming from. They had very little in the way of skills except a strong back and a dream that they wanted to fulfill. And many of them had this huge difficulty adjusting. But once they got here, because of circumstances beyond a lot of people's control, some were able to join unions, some were not. The African Americans often were brought in as strike breakers. That was hardly a way to build bonds between people. And so that there were opportunities for missed opportunities for getting to know one another. These people were essentially the same people, wanting the same thing, and sort of torn apart by great misunderstanding, cultural misunderstanding, and suspicion of one another.
There are two ways to cover a great social pattern of change. You can do it sociologically or historically, which means particularly a lot of numbers, a lot of statistics, or you can do it journalistically in the high sense of high journalism, focus in on real people. And for that, you've got to select a few representative figures, and you've done that. You've got essentially three families that you trace.
I have three families, and the goal was to be able to have the reader put themselves in the mindset, the heart of someone who had to make this big decision, perhaps a decision of their lives to leave home and hearth and the people that they knew for someplace else. I also wanted to make sure that people got a sense of the scope and the breadth of this migration. It wasn't to one city, it was to all cities north, Midwest, and West.
Though it rather depended where you started from. If you started from Mississippi, you wound up usually in Chicago.
You did. But if you were in Georgia or you were in North or South Carolina, you might end up in Washington, D.C.
You went up the East Coast.
Philadelphia or New York. Yeah. And if you were in Louisiana or Texas, you might very likely end up in California, Los Angeles, Oakland, Seattle. And so I needed three people to represent those three streams.
They're all fascinating people. And we meet lots of other people. I know you conducted, I read a figure, something like
1,200. I stopped counting after that.
That's incredible. One sees why it took you 15 years.
Yes.
But of all your people, the one that I found most fascinating is Ida Mae Gladney, though, of course, her real name is May Ida.
May Ida. And at a very young age, she decided to tell everybody to call her Ida Mae because she thought May Ida was too old-timey.
She came up here to Chicago.
She came
with
up to
her
Chicago
husband.
With her husband.
Let's tell that story.
She was a sharecropper's wife living in Chickasaw County, Mississippi, and she was terrible, awful at picking cotton. Just terrible at it, which I find fascinating in and of itself.
She says, like picking fuzz.
It's like picking fuzz. It was, they had to pick 100 pounds in order to get what would be viewed as the ration or the amount they needed to pick the goal, and she could never get to 100 pounds. And it would have required picking 7,000 bowls of cotton, which, if you can imagine how lightweight that is, it's like 7,000 feathers, you might imagine. And anyway, she was terrible at it. She could never get the magic number, and her husband was frustrated with her. The planner was frustrated with her, but she had other endearing qualities about her. In any case, they ended up leaving because a cousin of her husband's was beaten to within an inch of his life over a theft that he had not committed. The thing that they thought he had taken turned up the next day.
As you note, in those days in the Deep South, there was a lynching every 3 or 4 days.
A lynching every 3 or 4 days. They were essentially defecting from a caste system that controlled their every life, their every aspect of their everyday life. And that meant that it was illegal, it was against the law for a black person and a white person to play checkers together, for example, in Birmingham. It meant that in many southern courtrooms, there was actually a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. It's unfathomable for us to think about how someone would sit down and write that out as a law.
The notion was it would be corrupting for a white person to have to touch a Bible touched by a black person.
And then that would have a huge psychological effect on both races, sure, in that situation, because one group was fearful of any interaction with the other, and the other was fearful and had to have felt pressed down by the idea that anything that they might touch would be considered corrupted. It's almost unfathomable, really. In that particular case, that case became known because there was a time when, in a particular courtroom, they had to suspend the trial because they couldn't find the black Bible. So the bailiff had to go and find the Bible.
Sweet, oh, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
And we return to conversation with Isabel Wilkerson, professor of journalism at Boston University, and the author of a very important and an utterly fascinating new book titled The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, that has just recently been published by Random House. And it has been universally acclaimed by all who have reviewed it, and I add my small voice to that general acclaim. The book is absolutely fixating, or fixates one's interest. Human story is what writing is ultimately about, and this is rich with human story. Let's go back to the story of Dr. Foster.
Yes. Dr. Foster found that he was unable to practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana, and so he set out on a course for California. He viewed that as a better opportunity for himself and his young family. He set out alone, which is what is also typical of the sort of the immigrant or migrant course of action, and he found that he had underestimated the reach of Jim Crow when it came to the boundaries leaving the South, going out into the West, and he found that he was not able to find a place to rest and to stay.
It permeated the Southwest in those days.
Southwest, yeah. Absolutely. So he found that he had to drive, unexpectedly had to drive for basically three states to get to California without rest. He had to go through the desert at night, which he had not planned on, and he had to go through the hairpin curves and the mountains in order to get to California. During that dispiriting ride, he ended up wondering if he'd made the right decision, and you wonder if somebody in all of our families might have ever had to think that way, wonder if they'd made the right decision. The goal was to make this come alive for people, so I actually recreated that journey myself with my parents in the car with me. I rented a Buick, as he had, and he said if you'd had his Buick, you would want it too. He was quite the character. And so we followed to the letter the route that he had described that he had taken. My parents, I told them from the beginning, the rule is I can drive. I'm the only one who can drive because that's what Dr. Foster had done, and we must follow that to the letter. It was all my father could do to take the wheel from me. We got as far as Arizona, where the road began to turn mean. It got dark. We had hairpin curves. I wanted to experience what it was like when the eyes grow heavy, when the hands begin to swell, the fingers swell from gripping the wheel for so long. I began to veer off the road, and my parents at that point said, "Stop the car. For all of our sake, stop the car. And if you won't do that, let us out, at least." So we found a room in Yuma, Arizona. That's as far as we made it. I felt very disheartened that I had not been able to recreate to the letter his journey, but it also helped me feel even more empathy and understanding for what he'd had to endure. Because
what happened to him when he got to L.A.?
When he got to L.A., he found a very difficult go of it. Getting in. He had to actually getting established as a physician. It was not as easy as he'd anticipated. In other words, he found that there was, again, as we discussed before, this elite that was already there that was not welcoming to any newcomers. And so he had to actually go door to door to find patients at one point. Ultimately, though, he found that his greatest support came from others who had migrated from the South, newly arrived, and he opened his office doors to them, and he had a practice that was so successful that people actually would be waiting out in the hallway like refugees for him to come back. Now, they knew he was at the track. That's a whole other story because he was a huge gambler, but he was also a wonderful physician, apparently, by the reports of the people who would wait for hours for him to come back.
Did he do surgery, or did he do just general practice?
He did everything. He did surgery. He was able to live out his dreams as a surgeon.
And he had a good hospital hospital affiliation.
He had, several hospital affiliations, but he also had a very famous patient, Ray Charles. Mm-hmm. And Ray Charles came to him as another person who had migrated from the South. Ray Charles' wife had recommended that he go to see Dr. Foster, and they became really great friends. So much so that Ray Charles wrote a song about him called Hide Nor Hair, in which he describes, it's all fictional, but he describes Dr. Foster as being a bon vivant for whom Ray Charles is worried he might lose a girlfriend to, because Dr. Foster has medicine and money too, according to the song.
Did he marry?
He did.
What kind of family did he have?
He married the daughter, actually, of a university president. She was elite herself, and they all moved out to California. He had three daughters. One of them became a doctor like him. Another one became a public administrator, and another one became an artist representative, a speech pathologist, and many other things. And she actually has been based here in the Midwest. So, and then their children ended up being very successful too, and went on to college.
We've talked about two of the three characters that you focus on. The third is George Starling, who was the earliest migrant on your list, I think. He came up to New York City.
Yes, he came from Florida. He had been a college student but had to drop out because of the limits on them. Actually, they could not go to just any school, and the family couldn't afford to send him where he was going. So he ended up returning to the work in the part of Florida where he was from, which was citrus picking. It was quite dangerous, more dangerous than one might think. They had to climb up into 40-foot trees with these ladders that were spliced together. The conditions were bad and the pay was worse. And so he began to lead sit-downs in the groves. In other words, we are not going to pick unless you pay us a nickel more a box.
And the outcome of that was he was told that the people who employed him were planning to kill him.
Exactly. And he ended up having to flee for his life.
A good occasion to leave.
The question, he was not going to live long if he stayed there.
Yeah.
No, he was not. Terrible. So he went to Harlem.
And what happened to him there?
1945. He ended up in the job that you would least expect him to, because he said he was never returning to the South. And he took a job that took him back South immediately. He worked for the railroad as a porter. Yeah. And that meant that he was able to observe the migration going back and forth. And when he arrived back from one of those trips, he actually came into an understanding of how the North had its own issues in New York. He had returned from a very long run on the train, gone to get a beer with a friend. And it turned out that after they had set their beer glasses down, after they'd had their beer, the bartender, which was the way for whatever reason in New York, took the glass and smashed it against the counter. It made a crashing sound that got the attention of all the other people in the bar, which embarrassed him and his friend greatly. But it was an indication that they were not welcome there. That would have been in the late 40s.
It's the same as the Black Bible used by a black man.
Could not be used by a
incredible.
White person. Yeah.
Incredible. Of course, he was a sleeping car porter, and that was Philip Randolph Rand, the Union of Sleeping Car Porters, which was the first major black labor organization in the country.
Interesting that he had been doing that on his own in Florida in a dangerous way, because he didn't have the backup of a big organization. He was just doing this as a way of improving the circumstances of the people that were around him. And he ended up working in a field in which there was a great deal more organization. He never let that go. He was constantly on the lookout for injustice, and it showed in his behavior.
I invite you to do a mental experiment.
Yes.
Take these three people, George Starling, Ida Mae Gladney, and Dr. Foster, bring them all together for a conversation about life in America.
You know, that'd be really interesting, because, you know, they had no interest in meeting one another.
Yeah.
I had hoped I'd be able to do that. They seemed to not want to be interested. I'd mention one or the other, and they'd not be interested. It's almost as if I was cheating on them by telling them about the other. I think that they would all share the general feeling that the South had hurt them, rejected them, and left them no choice but to find someplace else. And they didn't really want to leave. Several of the people that I interviewed said they had not wanted to go. If they could live anywhere, it would have been in the South. But the South had rejected them. I mean, Richard Wright is one of the best examples of such a person. I mean, he left Natchez, Mississippi for Chicago in 1927.
It's from Wright that you get the title of your book, don't you?
It is.
What's that quotation?
The quotation?
You have it at the beginning of the book, please.
Yeah. It reads, "I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom.
Was it a warming sun? Did they bloom? If you ask these three people, what did you achieve in the North? Was this the right move? How do you feel about the life that you and your family have lived here? What would they say?
That's a really great question. I know the answer to that. And that is that they would say, we've made many mistakes in our lives, but leaving the South was not one of them. Every single one of them would have said that. In fact, that's essentially what they told me.
Mm-hmm.
They felt as if they'd made the right decision. They never looked back. Many of them, Foster in particular, rarely returned.